I think the vast majority of people who work in higher education have really good intentions about that, right? Like, it's not the industry you go into if you're trying to make the most money. It's certainly not the industry if you're trying to make a quick buck. People are here because they believe in the discipline that they're, you know, researching or educating. They believe in education in general. And so there are concerns about, hey, if we change an education delivery model or we, you know, phase out certain academic programs, like, is that going to be bad? Is it going to hurt students?
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast. I'm Tiffany Snyder, and I'm here with my co-host, Brad Garner. Hi, Brad.
Hello.
It's time for part two with Paul Friedman, and we're pretty excited about it. If you weren't able to catch part one, you can catch it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pandora, or Podbean. But for now, welcome to the podcast, Paul Friedman. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Well, I'm going to ask this question carefully, and you can answer carefully. But is part of that formula for those presidents looking at those pictures on the wall thinking, I don't want to be the last one, a fear of what faculty will say?
My father was a physics professor at Berkeley and Stanford.
Wow.
And sort of, you know, I come from a faculty background. So I'm going to say this with absolutely a lot of love. Yes, 100% yes. To drive real change through a shared governance model is very difficult. And
absolutely.
Presidents have to, a leader who's saying, hey, we're going to make changes to our business model, we're going to do things different than we've ever done them before, is already worried about what if it's not true. And then they have to, you know, fight faculty who are generally pretty resistant to change to make it happen. So they put themselves entirely on the line. If it fails, there's going to be a vote of no confidence, right? Like, they are putting everything on the line. That's a high risk, you know, for an individual, right? And that dissuades a lot of presidents from, you know, pushing through changes, even if they think that they're necessary, even if they're sitting looking at the balance sheet and saying, we got to do something different. I would say then there's another step. Even if you convince the faculty at certain institutions, then you have like alumni who push back and question why the college experience for somebody coming today is going to be any different than it was for them, you know, 30, 40, right, 60 years ago. And, you know, I think we've seen pretty recent examples like Mills College, you know, which just announced that in a couple of years, it's going to enroll its last student under its current incarnation. You know, that there was a point in time where Mills College was recognized to be, you know, an elite, you know, institution, world-class reputation. And it faced all the pressures that we just said, difficulty around changing, faculty that were resistant to change, alumni who were resistant to change. And, you know, ultimately that kept the institution doing a lot of what it was doing from when it was founded, but doesn't necessarily have it was no longer attractive to enough students to make the economic model work.
And in fairness to faculty, they probably have their own unique set of fears that what they've been doing for years, that they love to do, is not going to be obsolete. I won't be as comfortable. I don't think I can mess with technology and still teach my students. All those same kinds of fears, I'm guessing faculty, I think, are always hanging on the edge about becoming obsolete.
I think that's true. And I think it's not from a bad place. I think the vast majority of people who work in higher education have really good intentions about that, right? Like, it's not the industry you go into if you're trying to make the most money. It's certainly not the industry if you're trying to make a quick buck. People are here because they believe in the discipline that they're, you know, researching or educating. Yeah. They believe in education in general. Like, and so there are concerns about, hey, if we change an education delivery model or we, you know, phase out certain academic programs, like, is that going to be bad? Is it going to hurt students? Mm-hmm. Like, we were doing pretty well for a long time before. Like, why do we have to change the way that we're doing it now? And what if it doesn't work? So I think the concerns are coming from a fair place. I think what doesn't fully recognize is that what also happened is that the world changed, right? Mm-hmm. And that the needs of the students who are going to college, what they're going for is very different. The mm-hmm. age of the students, the likelihood to be have economic needs that are different than when education, when higher education was more of a luxury good, like, and the economy, you know, being, you know, a knowledge economy, like all these things have changed. And that requires the institutions to change themselves, and frankly requires faculty to change along with it. You don't have a God-given right to do what you were doing, you know, 50 years ago, just because it worked 50 years ago. You know, you can continue to try, but you could find yourself, you know, serving an increasingly small, you know, student population.
I think we'll use those last two sentences to market this particular podcast episode.
Yeah.
I don't remember what I just said, so I hope that's good. Yeah.
Trust us. You'll be fine. You'll be fine.
Yeah, you'll be fine. Our podcast is right in the pocket of EdTech. What are some of your favorite EdTech tools or anything that you can share with us that you like to dabble in that we can bring noise to?
I'm really interested in lately in how students are making decisions around courses. And there's a really cool, and that's been a, you know, the course registration, you know, process has been like a, you know, something that used to be pretty archaic and has been modernized, mm-hmm. but you really haven't looked at how you're influencing those choices in the right way. And there's a company called Stellic, which is a pretty small technology company, but they're starting to grow really quickly, who has really changed the whole like course selection process to be much more about a, you know, kind of student journey, and where they're, the institutions where they're being used, the level of engagement that students have around that course registration process, which is generally a boring process, it totally changes. And that the data then that institutions can get, like once you get students engaging around what courses they want, then you get data from an institution that says, I can start planning forward where I need to build my programs, where I need to hire more faculty, where I maybe need to contract, because you start to see sort of interest level, you know, way in advance of decision making. And so I think it's a, you know, it's one of those areas that is sort of super interesting. Another ed tech company is working with universities to re-enroll students who've stopped out or dropped out. It's called Re-Up Education.
Oh yeah.
And it's just part of what we've been talking about. It's like, as the modern learner just has a lot more going on in their lives, they're much more likely mm-hmm. to have a full-time job and more likely to have dependents. That means that their education journey might not be, you know, kind of 4 years head down. They might need to take a pause. They might need to come back. And I think that's increasingly to be expected. You know, we used to call them dropouts and think that it was because they weren't academically successful. Now we should think of them as stopouts who maybe for very good reasons have put a pause on their journey. And what Re-Up does is re-engages those stopouts to bring them back. And it's a layer of service and technology that I think institutions are going to increasingly need.
That's awesome. You were saying a student journey of registration, and I was having flashbacks to my student journey of registration was walking from building to building with my piece of paper and my pen for different faculty to sign and just making sure it made it back to the registrar's office.
I remember a similar experience. And I think as it went online, it, you know, the pieces of paper have changed, but like the thought behind the system, you know, isn't even more, but it's a real opportunity to really start helping learners think about, you know, what about that whole journey.
Yeah.
And I would guess that a lot of the adult learners that you interface with or your company does, who are currently employed full time, have families, those kinds of things, are probably much more goal directed than what we used to call the traditional college student, 18 mm-hmm. to 21 year old, more of a sense of what they want to accomplish.
I think that's true in part. What I would say that there still is, you know, particularly there still are students who are making education decisions very anecdotally based on, you know, what they saw in a television show, what job they might be interested in, you know, who people that they knew in what jobs that they did. Like, I think that we, you know, they're, although there's a ton of information available about career decisions and what that aligns to academic choice, like, I still think that's a very messy problem that hasn't been, you know, solved particularly well. And you do find learners, even, you know, adult learners that are studying for a program without clarity on why. What is different is it's much more likely that it's going to be a job outcome.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is it needs the time availability is a lot shorter for education to feel relevant. It really has to make people feel like it's worth their time, because the time trade-off is there. Like, they are to study, you know, they're not giving up time playing frisbee in the quads or whatever the idyllic image of a quote unquote traditional student. They're giving up like going to the grocery store or taking care of their kids or doing their job. Like, the time poverty is real. And I think that institutions that serve working adults need to have deep, deep respect for the time that they're using of their learners.
That is an excellent point. And I love that term, time poverty.
Yeah.
Because that's a real thing.
Mm-hmm. It's an absolute real thing. And at Guild, our employers are paying, in some cases, you know, allowing their employees to go debt-free to great universities, you know, fully debt-free, which is a wonderful program. But even in that, we try to be very respectful of the students' time. Like, even if they're not paying a dollar, we still want to make sure that they're going to an institution that's going to serve their investment in their time well, because that investment in the time is probably their most precious resource.
And does that investment imply I'm going to stay with the company necessarily?
In general, one of the reasons why an employer, you know, finds a return on investment for investing in their employees' education in this way is that people do tend to stay with their company. And so one of the ROI cases is that it means that people don't leave and you don't have to hire somebody to train somebody to replace them. And that's a huge return on investment for a company. It's not the only reason. The other reasons are it becomes a huge path for promotion. So Chipotle, you know, as somebody who takes an educational program that provided through Guild is 7.5 times more likely to be promoted to manager. So it becomes an internal mobility path. And then it also provides value from a diversity, equity, and inclusion perspective, because, you know, most companies, if they were able to get their mid-management and their upper management to be as diverse as their frontline population, they would feel like they were doing a much better job than they probably are in terms of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And so providing pathways where you can train frontline staff and give them that pathway to internal mobility also has a return on investment from a DEI lens as well.
And those employees probably also have a new sense of pride, accomplishment, and that certainly probably translates into them being better employees.
Better employees, better members of their community. There's a big return on investment for education in addition to the productivity gains of learning a better job or learning a better skill. And from our learners, we find that, you know, as I mentioned, the vast majority say, I'm going to get an education because I want to get a promotion or I want a higher paying job. Another subset, the second most popular, is I'm doing this to be an example to somebody, to my family, to my peers, sometimes to prove something to themselves. And so it's some combination of those, you know, two reasons are the driving factors for most adult learners in our experience to be going to school.
It sounds like through Guild, they'll have an advisor through the institution, but then they have a coach through Guild. So there's so much support, and we know that support and feedback is everything.
That support layer really makes a huge difference, particularly for, you know, adult learners who aren't going to have as much opportunity to interact with their peers in like a campus environment, right? And so providing that support infrastructure that can help through the tough times, that can navigate questions, you know, to deal with changes that happen at an institution, it's a really important layer.
Yeah.
So every time before our show, Tiffany and I do rock, paper, scissors, and the winner gets to ask the question that leads people to tune into Digital to Learn. And I won today. So my question is, what's next for Paul Friedman?
That's going to be the reason why people tune in to learn. I'm worried about your audience.
Absolutely.
So Guild is just starting our journey. We're mentioning the 3 million employees under benefit. And at some respects, that's a large number. But, you know, we think the opportunity is, you know, the 88 million Americans who don't have a degree past, you know, high school, and certainly that the economic environment demands of them. So we're just getting started. And I think that, you know, that we have a really strong opportunity to work with, to really become ubiquitous in, you know, corporate America. Right now, our employers that we're working with are kind of the leading voices on investing in their employees' education. And they're frankly getting a big competitive advantage in the job market. They're able to recruit because of the benefit that they're providing. They're able to retain talent because of the benefit they're provided. Their talent's more diverse. What we expect to happen is, at some point in time, the folks that aren't doing a program like you could do with Guild are going to be behind. And they're going to have to catch up. And so even now, though, we're right now with the early adopters, we very much see the arc that this becomes a ubiquitous way of thinking about investing in employees' education. And so, you know, we're expected to be around for the journey. So, you know, what's next for me is going to be the same thing I've been doing for the last little while now.
I'm so intrigued by your model. I'm guessing a lot of these employees have thought to themselves, I don't think I can afford to go to college. I never thought I was going to be able to do this. It just opens up a whole new world for them, based upon the commitment and the interest of their employers.
Yeah, no, it's great.
It's fascinating.
And even if they don't spend a dollar, we care very much about the time that they're investing with us. They don't have to spend a dollar and they don't have to take out debt. And so the other thing that we're really proud of is like the net reduction in student loans that happened because of this investment. Because, you know, for the students that we're dealing with, that, you know, they would be chalking up loans in order to be able to go to a program in any other way. And, you know, being able to have a model that avoids all that is really great.
Absolutely.
So Brad was actually, he does no proof that he won rock, paper, scissors. So I'm going to cheat. And there's another question that we ask guests, and you're lucky you get both questions. If there's a projection about the future of higher ed, we want to have it recorded on the podcast so we can refer back to it and point and say, hey, we captured that first. You've kind of given us some projections for Guild, but is there any projection based on your observations of higher ed and the changing landscape? Anything that you can foresee happening that we can say you heard it here?
Yeah. So I think, what year is it now? It's 2021. So let's say by 2030, there will be 25% fewer universities, either through universities going out of business or mergers and consolidations, but just separate entities. In the next decade, there we 25% fewer than we have today.
So who will survive, the best or the cleverest?
Both.
Or both.
The best and the cleverest will survive. The folks that were never leading their category and aren't changing their model are going to go out of business. I mean, the business model for higher education for the elite universities works well. I mean, it's expensive. It's a good focus on an affluent population, but it works well. It has a strong return on investment. Those institutions are going to be fine, even if they have to increase tuition more. They'll still be fine, and because there's a value proposition. The universities that have become very innovative and are some of them are growing like, you know, are crazy. Southern New Hampshire has, you know, well over 100,000 students now, and the clever universities are thriving as well. It's the institutions where, you know, they never been leaders in whatever category they operate in, and also are unwilling to kind of change their ways and innovate their models. Those are the ones that are going to have, you know, face real economic risk. I think in that population, you know, a lot of them will go out of business.
Yeah. So let's mark our calendars right now. January 1st, 2030, we'll have Paul back on Digital to Learn, and we'll see if you're right.
We'll see. I mean, if it happens sooner than that, maybe we can. I'll come back the day that 25% have gone out of it.
Yeah.
Let's do that. Paul, thanks for being with us. You are delightful and thoughtful and challenge us in so many ways to the ways that we think about higher ed.
Well, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun.
And you're also providing a great service to those 3 million employees. That's exciting.
Yeah, we appreciate that, and we take a lot of pride in that mission, and really work hard to execute. You know, because we do think that when it works well, we are really, you know, helping people.
Well, thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in today. We're going to have more resources associated with this podcast available on digitaltolearn.com. That's a numerical two. And also in our posts on LinkedIn, we're going to link to Paul and his colleagues at Guild. You can find out more information about it.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.